vampire certainly qualified. The theory also fit with what Candorous had told her. The Mandalorian had claimed that Revan asked him to restore the glory and strength of his people so they could stand against the Sith should they ever try to invade the Republic again. According to the census records, the Sith Empire comprised several dozen planets. The Sith who had taken Revan might have come from any one of those worlds. If she could figure out which was his home, she might be able to narrow her search. However, as she cross-checked the names and galactic coordinates of the listed worlds, Mitra quickly realized that they were all planets already known to the Republic. Over the last 1,000 years, the Jedi had systematically purged every planet mentioned in the census of their Sith influence. These were the records of the Sith Empire that was no more. Refusing to give up, she dug deeper into the data files they had gathered, examining records pertaining to Nathema itself. For several days, she pored through the archives, stopping neither to eat nor to sleep. Every few hours, she refreshed herself with a quick meditation break, drawing on the Force to replenish her fading stores of energy and mental focus so she could continue her work. There were tens of thousands of government documents and reports collected from over 50 different agencies. But Mitra refused to be daunted by the monumental task. She continued to pore through the archives, and slowly, a picture began to emerge. The people of Nathema had spent their last days in a terrified and desperate state. They had known it was only a matter of time until the Jedi found them. And the ruler of Nathema, a Sith, named Lord Vitiate, had preyed upon his people's fear. Transcripts of Vitiate's public speeches were filled with graphic warnings of what the Jedi would do once they arrived. Records confirmed that his speeches had been broadcast and transmitted across the whole of the Empire, sowing the seeds of terror among all the Sith worlds. Vitiate had consciously and carefully driven the people into a state of panic, knowing they would blindly follow anyone who offered hope. Vitiate was quick to fulfill that role, and he put out a call for all the other surviving Dark Lords to join him on Nathema in a ritual that he promised would lead the Sith to salvation. At the same time he was doing this, Vitiate also had top historians and scientists secretly trying to determine the location of a planet called Dromund Kaas, the long-lost homeworld of the original Sith species. Mitra discovered this only because of T3's exceptional slicing skills. The astromech had not only copied and translated all the data from the archives, but also decrypted the passcodes to unlock classified government files, which he had then marked as having top priority to help simplify Mitra's investigations. The team Vitiate assigned to search out Dromund Kaas had operated in total secrecy, sequestered day and night in a research lab as they studied the ancient star maps and astrogation charts. Fortunately, the leader of the team had been a meticulous record keeper, and every step of the process had been carefully documented, including the moment of triumph when they were finally able to theorize a hyperspace route that would lead them safely back to Dromund Kaas, where the Jedi could never follow. The final entry in the team leader's project log detailed her efforts to prepare her findings so they could be presented to Vitiate in person. Lord Vitiate publicly proclaimed the commencement of his great ritual just 3 days later. Chronologically, there were no records after the proclamation. Nothing from the research team. Nothing from any of the other departments. It was as if every member of Nathema's sprawling government had simultaneously vanished from existence. Even without any official account of what had happened next, however, it wasn't hard for Mitra to put the missing pieces together. The ritual had obviously destroyed Nathema, snuffing out all life on the world. Lord Vitiate had offered his people hope, and instead had brought them a fate worse than death. Utter eradication of life, existence, and even the Force. Mitra was no expert on dark side sorcery, but it was safe to assume Vitiate not only survived the ritual, but emerged more powerful than ever. And with the destruction of everyone on Nathema, including his research team, he alone would have known the location of Dromund Kaas. The plan was both horrifying and brilliant. In addition to becoming more powerful than Mitra could imagine, Vitiate could blame the extinction of his homeworld on the Jedi, further panicking the remaining Sith worlds. Then he could have offered them a glimmer of hope, promising to lead all those who swore loyalty to him to a place where the Jedi would never find them. If Vitiate had been as cunning as Mitra imagined him to be, he wouldn't have led his followers directly to Dromund Kaas. Instead, he would have taken them on a long and trying exodus, during which the Sith would have been forced to turn to him time and again for support and guidance, their dependence on him growing until he went from leader to hero to savior. By the time they finally reached Dromund Kaas, they would likely have worshipped Vitiate as a god, all-powerful and all-knowing. Fascinating history, to be sure, but Mitra didn't know how it could help her find Revan. Vitiate's grand plan had taken place over 1,000 years earlier. Surely Vitiate himself was long dead, and even if he had led the Sith to Dromund Kaas, there was no guarantee they were still there. There were other possibilities to consider as well. The Sith were an aggressive and warlike species. It was possible that Dromund Kaas was just one of many worlds in the Unknown Regions that had fallen under their control over the last 1,000 years. It was possible, and even likely, that the red-skinned being who had captured Revan had taken him to an entirely different planet, one she had never even heard of. But at least she had a lead. And no matter how slim the odds of finding her mentor, Mitra wasn't about to give up. She trusted in the Force. Eventually, it would lead her to him. From the census records, it was clear that humans were, or had been, part of the Sith Empire. If Vitiate's followers had settled on Dromund Kaas, she should be able to pass among them by posing as a mercenary, a role she knew well from the years she had spent living as the exile in the Outer Rim. As she punched the hyperspace coordinates from the research team leader's logbook into the nav computer, T3 came over and chirped inquisitively. "We're going to a world called Dromund Kaas," Mitra said, as the Ebon Hawk made the jump to light speed. "If Revan's there, we'll find him."
Chapter 19. Scourge typed in the access code to unlock the door leading to the underground holding cells built beneath Nyriss' stronghold. He didn't acknowledge the guard standing watch as he stepped through, and they made no move to stop him. He had passed the checkpoint hundreds of times, and they had stopped bothering with Murtaugh's official security protocols long ago. He descended the stairs to the dimly lit dead-end hall at the bottom. There were 4 doors, 2 on either side. Beside each door was a monitor, showing a holovid of what was happening inside each cell. 3 of the cells were empty. The 4th had been occupied by the same prisoner for the past 3 years. The image showed Revan, seated in a familiar position, his legs crossed and his hands resting palms up on his thighs. His eyes were closed, his face calm. Though Scourge knew that had as much to do with the medication as the meditation. The prisoner had not left his cell for even a single moment since his capture. There was a refresher in the corner, a small sink and a bed against one wall. In the beginning, they had brought in a chair to strap him to for his interrogation sessions, but after the first few months, Scourge convinced Nyriss that torturing Revan was an unproductive waste of both time and resources. By that time, Revan had already told them everything, as much as he could remember, at least. He had revealed that the Jedi had wiped away most of his early memories, including all traces of what had happened to him in the Emperor's dungeons. He had confessed that he had come to Nathema in the hopes of reclaiming his lost past, following the same trail he had embarked on years before. He couldn't tell Nyriss anything about what she really asked. And though she still suspected he had been dominated by and then broken free of the Emperor's will, the scientists she had brought in to study him had been unable to find anything useful with all their testing and research. After 6 months, Nyriss had lost interest in her Jedi prisoner. Her attention moved on to other plots and intrigues, though she kept him alive just in case. But while Nyriss ignored Revan, Scourge had become obsessed with him. The Jedi's command of and connection to the Force was unlike anything Scourge had sensed in anyone else. Even though Revan was constantly drugged, it was impossible not to sense his strength. After years of studying him, Scourge had come to understand why the Jedi had such a fearsome reputation among the Sith. With men and women like Revan in their ranks, it was easy to see how they had beaten back the Sith invasion 1,000 years earlier. And it confirmed what he already suspected. The Emperor's plan to launch another invasion against the Republic at this point in time was tantamount to suicide. However, it was more than the Jedi's raw power that interested Scourge. Unlike all the instructors at the Academy, or even Nyriss herself, Revan had experienced both the light and the dark sides of the Force. He had a unique perspective on its strengths and weaknesses, and Scourge was eager to learn from his experience. It hadn't been easy, of course. Revan had regarded him as an enemy at first. Scourge was the being who tortured him for information. But over time, that had slowly changed. Revan was held in almost total seclusion. The guards were forbidden to speak with him, and once Nyriss all but forgot about him, the weekly visits from Scourge were his only source of conversation or contact. Scourge understood that long periods of solitary confinement could be even harder to endure than the brutal physical suffering of the interrogations. Loneliness and isolation would eat away at the mind and the spirit. It was inevitable that Revan would forge a relationship with the only person he ever had any contact with. It was a slow and subtle process, and even now they still regarded each other with suspicion and mistrust. But eventually, the instinctive need for interaction had caused Revan to open up. He would give carefully guarded answers to Scourge's questions about his beliefs and philosophies, or let slip bits and pieces of his knowledge of the Force. No matter how long they spoke, Revan was careful to say very little. But over the years, the tiny drops of wisdom had accumulated into a great reservoir for Scourge to draw on. Nyriss may have had no further use for Revan, but Scourge was going to exploit this invaluable resource for all its worth. Scourge unlocked the door to Revan's cell. The Jedi was still wearing the same brown robes he had been captured in. The clothes, like the prisoner himself, had not been properly cleaned in 3 years. Scourge winced at the stale, pungent scent wafting off the human, but it was a small price to pay, considering how much he had already gained from their regular visits.
"Revan,"
he said, noting that the prisoner's eyes were still closed.
"I wish to speak with you."
Revan opened his eyes, as if responding to the Sith's voice, though in truth he had sensed his approach from the moment he began to descend the staircase. It was difficult to draw upon the Force through the veil of mind-altering chemicals in his system, but over the years he had learned a handful of tricks. Though they had spoken hundreds of times, the Sith had never told Revan his name. Not that it mattered. To Revan he was nothing more than a tool, his one hope of ever getting out of the cell alive. In the first few months, he had hoped that someone would come for him. Candorus, or T3-M4, or maybe even Bastila, drawn to him by the Force. But as time passed, his drug-addled brain finally realized he was truly alone. He had tried reaching out to Bastila with the Force, but the drugs and the vast distance of an entire galaxy must have stopped her from sensing his need. He'd almost given up once he realized there would be no rescue. His situation seemed hopeless. And then his muddled mind seized on the Sith interrogator. It was clear the red-skinned being was subservient to the withered hag who had been present during the early interrogations. It was also obvious that he was more than just a thug hired to torture information out of prisoners. Revan had sensed the force in him. He had incredible potential. Fortunately for Revan, he was also arrogant, overconfident, and ambitious. Over the course of many months, Revan fed that ambition with tiny crumbs meant to draw the Sith Lord in. He spoke of his past, knowing his triumphs over Malak and other powerful individuals would feed the young Sith's desire to rise above his current station. Revan also made a point of bringing up the Force regularly. He had once served the dark side, and he understood its insatiable lust for power. The chance to learn something, anything new about the Force, was a temptation the Sith could not resist. He was willing to give the Sith glimpses of his wisdom, because with each conversation, he learned a little bit more about his captors. The interrogator was careful. He tried to reveal as little of himself and the world outside the cell as possible. But over many months and hundreds of conversations, it was inevitable some things would slip. To facilitate the process, Revan had carefully forged a relationship with the anonymous Sith, establishing a familiar rapport that made it easier for the Sith to unknowingly open up about himself, even as he thought he was using Revan. His efforts had been well rewarded. Over the past 3 years, he had learned much about the Sith society the Republic believed to be extinct. He knew they were ruled by an emperor. He knew they controlled hundreds of worlds. About a year earlier, he'd learned the name of the female who had overseen the first few interrogations. Her name was Nyriss, and she was one of the Emperor's hand-picked advisors. At one point, his captor had let slip that the Emperor was secretly planning an invasion against the Republic. More important, he had revealed that he and Nyriss, along with many other Sith, were determined to stop him. Revan had seized on that shared goal, and for the past few months, he had been playing on it at every opportunity. It all might be futile. All his efforts might amount to nothing more than a game he was playing, merely to help pass the endless hours of his incarceration. But if there was a chance, however small, that he could somehow use this knowledge to break free of his prison, he intended to take it. The Jedi had opened his eyes, but he still seemed to be lost in thought. Scourge wondered if they had altered his medication recently. Every few months they had to switch him to a new formula, as his body became more resistant to the daily dose of drugs meant to keep him docile and helpless. For the first few days after each switch, Revan seemed even more out of it than usual.
"Revan,"
he repeated, speaking more loudly. He clapped his hand sharply, the sound echoing off the walls of the cell.
"I'm sorry, my lord,"
Revan said in response, slurring his words slightly.
"I'm having trouble focusing. It's good to see you again,"
he added with a faint smile.
"I always enjoy your visits."
Scourge would never admit to it to anyone, of course, but he also enjoyed them. He had developed a great respect and even admiration for Revan. Ironic, given how much his opinion of Nyriss had gone down in the last few months.
"You seem troubled, my lord."
"Nyriss still refuses to take any real action against the Emperor,"
he grumbled. It felt good to say the words out loud. That was an unexpected benefit of being the only person who ever spoke to the prisoner. Anything he said in the cell would never leave these walls. Here he could vent his frustrations aloud, without fear of reprisal.
"She tells me we must be patient, but her energies and resources are focused on besting her rivals on the Dark Council."
"Nyriss is driven by fear,"
Revan explained, speaking in the slow, monotonous cadence Scourge had never really gotten used to.
"Openly striking against the Emperor puts her life at risk. Her own immediate survival is more important to her than the fate of your empire."
"These are powerful allies who could be persuaded to help her,"
Scourge replied.
All they need is someone to step up and take charge. All they need is a leader to spur them to action.
I was betrayed by Malak,
Revan reminded him.
Nyriss is afraid the same thing could happen to her. If she steps forward as leader, she can no longer hide in the shadows with the others. She will be exposed, and it would only take one ambitious rival to betray her to the Emperor and bring everything crashing down.
Scourge nodded, remembering how Nyriss had done the same thing to eliminate Darth Cedrix. At the time he had believed her when she had said it was for the good of the cause, but now he suspected it had just been an excuse to remove a rival from the Dark Council.
If all the conspirators are too afraid to step forward, the Emperor will never be stopped,
Scourge muttered.
Eventually he will lead us into a war we cannot win, and the Jedi will wipe us out in retaliation. Ultimately, doing nothing is the most dangerous choice of all.
Nyriss blinds herself to that truth. That is the way of the dark side,
Revan said.
Those who follow it are driven by fear and ambition. They are too selfish to see that great victories often require great sacrifice.
Scourge grimaced. Sometimes he grew tired of Revan's preaching against the dark side. In this case, however, the Jedi was at least partially correct. Nyriss wouldn't think twice about sacrificing an ally or a follower, but she would never consider sacrificing herself. Revan, on the other hand, had journeyed across the galaxy in the face of unknown dangers because he thought there might be something that threatened his beloved Republic. He had put himself in harm's way for something he believed in. A year earlier, Scourge would have laughed at his foolishness. After all, what had Revan accomplished besides becoming a prisoner? Now, however, he understood that though the Jedi had failed, at least he had made the effort. At least he'd had a chance to succeed. Nyriss, it seemed, wasn't even going to make the attempt. She had failed to stop the Emperor before she had even begun.
You need to find another ally to your cause, Revan said. Someone powerful, but who is not caught up in the politics of the Dark Council.
Scourge laughed out loud at what Revan was clearly implying.
You must be growing desperate if you think you can talk me into helping you escape.
Mentally, Revan winced. He had pushed too far, too fast. Instead of subtle manipulation, he had stumbled into revealing a clumsy and obvious ploy. He never would have made such a foolish mistake if his mind was clear. But he thought it might still be possible to salvage the situation. He had to give the Sith something else to focus on. Something he cared about above everything else.
We share a common goal,
Revan admitted.
We both want to stop the Emperor from invading the Republic. But I am not proposing an alliance.
He paused.
I do not need your help to escape. The Force has shown me that my freedom is drawing near.
The Force has shown you? What do you mean? Have you had a vision?
As Revan suspected, his jailer had never experienced a vision through the Force. It wasn't unusual. The phenomenon was much rarer in those who followed the dark side. Their focus was internal. They used the Force as a tool, rather than seeing themselves as instruments of the Force's will. They were not accustomed to opening themselves up to the Force for guidance and direction.
The Force has shown me that my future lies beyond these walls,
Revan lied.
I don't put much faith in visions and prophecy,
the Sith said.
Have you ever felt a premonition of danger through the Force?
Revan asked, trying to help him understand.
Sensed a threat before it was revealed?
Of course.
the visions are merely an extrapolation of this. The Force flows across both space and time. It links the past, present, and future.
It is said that Naga Sadao had visions of the Sith crushing the Republic during the Great Hyperspace War,
Scourge countered.
We both know that that never came to pass.
The future is always in motion. The Force grants us visions that show us only one of many possible outcomes.
Then what use are they?
They can guide our actions, give us direction. They can show us a path we wish to follow, or one we can try to avoid.
Like the vision that brought you here? Scourge asked. The dream of Dromund Kaas and its storm-covered sky.
That was a memory, not a vision,
Revan reminded him.
But the Force does sometimes speak to us through our dreams.
And what does your vision show you? How do you make your great escape from this dungeon?
Revan chose his next words carefully, his dulled wit sensing an opportunity. He knew his best chance, perhaps his only chance of escape, was with the Sith's help. But he could not be the one to suggest the alliance. The Sith Lord had to think it was his idea. That was why he had fabricated the lie about the vision, to draw attention away from his clumsy efforts to convince the Sith to help him. Now, however, he had an opportunity to plant a seed.
You will understand in time,
he said cryptically, knowing the other would dwell on the hidden meaning behind his words. The Sith was already obsessed with him. He hungered to tap into Revan's understanding of the Force, and the Jedi knew he dominated the red-skinned being's conscious and unconscious thoughts. It would only be natural for Revan to sometimes be the subject of the Sith Lord's dreams. Hopefully, the Sith would come to believe that his ordinary dreams were actually visions granted by the Force. If all went well, he would come to believe there was a greater power trying to draw them together. He might decide of his own accord that Revan was the key to defeating the Emperor, spurring him to help the Jedi escape. It was a long shot, but Revan had nothing else to hope for.
I have no wish to play your games,
the Sith snapped, annoyed by the enigmatic response. He turned on the heel of his boot without saying a word and marched out of the cell, sealing the door behind him. Revan knew from experience it would be at least a week before he returned. The abrupt ending to their conversation and the impending prolonged absence were intended as punishment. His interrogator had long ago replaced physical torture with the supposed mental anguish of isolation. For most prisoners, this would have been an effective tool. But Revan was able to endure the long periods alone by meditating on the Force. At times like these, he would try to reach out to Bastila, hoping at least to let her know he was still alive. He opened himself up to the Force. As it flowed through him, images of the woman he loved danced through his head. And then suddenly, they were gone, replaced by the amorphous face of another.
Mitra,
Revan gasped, as the features shifted sharply into focus. They held for an instant, and then vanished. Revan knew this was more than some mere recollection of a lost friend. It had been too intense and powerful to be a memory. It was almost as if in describing the nature of Force visions to the Sith, he had triggered one of his own. Though it had lasted only a second, the meaning was abundantly clear.
Mitra was coming to rescue him.
Chapter 20. Mitra fought to keep the Ebon Hawk steady on its descent through the fierce storms raging in the skies above Kaas City spaceport. She knew the storm-ravaged world had to be the world Candorus had spoken of, the one Revan had seen in his dreams. The dark side was powerful here. It was strong enough to send a shiver down her spine. But the sensation was infinitely better than the awful nothingness of Nathema. As she brought the ship in to land,
she knew with a sudden and unshakable certainty that Revan was somewhere on this world.
"He's here, T3,"
she informed her companion, trying to contain her excitement.
"I can feel it."
The droid beeped eagerly.
"It won't be that easy,"
she replied.
"I'll need to scout around a bit, get a feel for this world."
The droid whistled apprehensively.
"Just stay close and follow my lead,"
she told him.
"We'll be fine."
A few minutes later, she had successfully settled the Hawk on one of the spaceport's many landing paths.
"Nobody here knows I'm a Jedi,"
she reminded her astromech companion just before they descended the boarding ramp.
"Let's try to keep it that way."
Her lightsaber was tucked safely out of sight, and she had changed from her brown robes into black pants and a sleeveless red top. It was unlikely anyone here would recognize the traditional outfit of the Jedi Order, but she wasn't taking any chances. A customs official was waiting for them outside the ship, a middle-aged human female. The fact that humans could hold official government positions was a good sign. They were obviously common enough on Dromund Kos that she wouldn't automatically draw attention here because of her species.
"Your vessel is unregistered,"
the woman told her in Basic, her voice simultaneously accusing and bored.
"You'll have to come with me."
Mitra wasn't surprised to be greeted in the familiar language. The Sith had once been an empire controlling multiple worlds, cultures, and societies. Naturally, they would fall back on a common language, and Basic was by far the simplest and most widespread choice.
"I like to keep my comings and goings off the record," she replied.
"That can be arranged,"
the woman said with a quick glance to make sure there was nobody within earshot.
"Naturally, we charge a fee for that kind of premium service."
Mitra had no idea what kind of currency was used on Dromund Kos, but she highly doubted they'd take Republic credits.
"I converted my funds into something a little easier to carry,"
she explained, holding up a small but perfectly cut diamond. The customs official's eyes lit up as she stared at the valuable gemstone.
"If you keep my arrival off the record, I'll make sure you're rewarded once I turn these into something a little easier to spend,"
Mitra promised. The woman's eyes narrowed suspiciously.
"I have a strict payment up front policy,"
she said.
"Maybe you could make an exception this one time, seeing as how we're both human,"
Mitra suggested, reaching out with the Force to give the woman's psyche a gentle nudge.
"I guess I could make an exception this one time,"
the woman said with an affable shrug,
"seeing as how we're both human."
"I knew we could work something out,"
Mitra replied with a smile.
"Now, I don't suppose you'd know the name of someone in the city who'd give me a fair price for my stones."
"Larvich, your best bet,"
the other woman told her.
"He drives a hard bargain, but he won't try to cheat you. Let me give you the directions."
Mitra decided to walk to Larvich's store rather than hire a speeder. Wandering the streets of Kos City on foot would give her a better feel for the planet and its people, making it easier to fit in. The population seemed to be primarily made up of the red-skinned Sith and humans, all dressed in standardized uniforms or military garb. She noticed a handful of Zabrak and Twi'leks. Unlike the Sith and humans, they did not wear uniforms, and without exception, they were all fitted with shock collars. With a start, Mitra realized that the unfortunate slaves were likely descended from prisoners who'd been taken by Sith 1,000 years earlier during the Great Hyperspace War. The directions the customs official had given her were simple, and she found her destination without any trouble. From the outside, Larvich's shop didn't look like the kind of place one would choose to conduct illegal business. It was situated in the middle of the street, and its window boasted the same official government seal she had noticed on virtually every building she'd passed along the way. She stepped into Larvich's store and made a quick evaluation of her surroundings. It looked like a cross between a pawn shop and a supply post. The tall, gray-haired man behind the counter was wearing a red shirt and black pants, both freshly pressed. On his left shoulder were several bars that probably represented some kind of military rank, and the left breast pocket was emblazoned with the same symbol that adorned his window. Mitra had expected to find herself in a shady black market operation, but clearly she was in some kind of official government-controlled business. Still, she had nowhere else to go, so she marched straight up to the gray-haired man and dumped a handful of gems on the counter.
"Please present your Imperial identification card,"
he started to say, but the routine greeting died in his mouth when he saw the small fortune scattered across his countertop. His eyes went wide, first with greed, and then with fear. Leaping from behind the counter, he rushed to the front of the shop and quickly closed and locked the door.
"What do you think you're doing?"
he demanded in a low voice, peering through the window to see if anyone had noticed his sudden dash across the store. Mitra slowly brought her right hand up to the lightsaber hidden at her belt.
"I was told you're the man to see about business I want to keep off the record."
I am,
Larvet assured her, regaining some of his composure.
"But you can't just toss your stuff out on the counter for anyone to see. What if an Imperial inspector happened to wander in?"
"Sorry," Mitra said. "I didn't realize it was a big deal."
Larvet snorted derisively.
"Great, a subjugate. Here's a tip, Offworlder. Next time you visit Droman Kos, learn the customs first."
Mitra nodded and let her hand drop, but she remained vigilant.
"How did you find out about me?"
Larvet asked.
"Who sent you?"
"Does it matter?" Mitra replied.
Larvet shook his head and made his way back over to inspect the stones still sitting atop the counter.
"Is this the full extent of your collection?"
he asked, picking up one of the gems and bringing it up to his aging eye for closer inspection.
"It's as much as I'm willing to sell right now."
"I understand,"
he said with a smile.
"Do you need the credits immediately, or can you wait a few weeks?"
"What's the difference?"
"I can offer more if you give me time to find the right buyer,"
he explained. Mitra shook her head.
"I don't have that kind of time."
"That is unfortunate,"
he said sympathetically.
"That will have to be reflected in the price, of course."
"Of course."
"I'm willing to offer 7,000 Imperial credits for the lot,"
he said, leaning back and crossing his arms to signify the price was non-negotiable. Mitra wasn't about to fall for such an obvious ploy. Even though she had no concept of what an Imperial credit was actually worth, she had done enough haggling in her day to know that this opening offer was merely a baseline.
20,000,
she countered, knowing it was a ridiculously high number.
"Even if you could wait to find a buyer, I could never go higher than 18,
he answered.
"I'll give you 10.
"Make it 15, and I promise I'll come to you first the next time I'm looking to deal."
"I'll give you 12,
he said, wagging a finger in her face.
"You won't find anybody else who'll go higher than 11.
"I'll sell them for 13 and some information," she answered.
"What kind of information?"
"I'm looking for someone. A friend. I need the name of a contact who knows how to find people."
"People that don't want to be found?"
"I'd rather not say."
The storekeeper crossed his arms again and stroked his chin thoughtfully.
"Make it 12-5 and we have a deal. I'll even set up the meeting."
10 minutes later, Mitra walked out of his establishment with 12,500 Imperial credits and an appointment to meet someone called Setchel in 2 days. Mitra was surprised by the high-class atmosphere of the Nexus Room. Over the past 2 days, she'd come to learn that Imperial society was all about status, caste, and class. Clearly, her contact was a being of significant rank. She was greeted at the door by a young human male wearing expensive clothes and a prominently displayed slave collar. Larvet must have provided a description of her, because he seemed to know who she was.
"Welcome to the Nexus Room,"
the young man said, casting his gaze respectfully to the ground.
"Master Setchel is expecting you."
In Mitra's eyes, slavery was one of the most vile and despicable practices in the galaxy. The Republic had officially condemned slavery, though she knew it still existed under euphemisms like indentured service or lifelong personal attendant. And on Hutt-controlled planets, which were outside Republic jurisdiction, individuals were openly bought and sold like chattel. But somehow what she had encountered on Dromund Kaas seemed much worse. In the Sith Empire, slavery was a societal institution, governed by laws and regulations, and seemingly accepted without question by the citizens. Slaves were symbols of rank. The wealthy and powerful used them as status symbols to be paraded out in front of their peers. There was an abject hopelessness in the eyes of the slaves. They were condemned to a lifetime of servitude with no chance of freedom. Even on Hutt worlds, slaves could at least dream of one day escaping to the Republic and starting a new life. But in the Sith Empire, slaves had nowhere to run. Every planet would condemn them. At best, an escaped slave would be returned to a wrathful owner or claimed by a new one. Multiple escape attempts were met with public execution, a slow and agonizing death, according to what Mitra had seen in the official records from Nathema.
"Forgive me, mistress,"
the young man said, bowing low and folding his hands together in a universal gesture of supplication.
"But droids are not allowed inside the club."
"Wait here, T3,
Mitra said. Her voice was sharp as she fought to contain her outrage at the young man's circumstances. Unfortunately, the slave thought her barely contained anger was directed at him, and he began to tremble. She could see the terror in his eyes, and she could only imagine what punishments he would be subjected to if he offended a guest of the club. But he no doubt faced even worse consequences if he were to violate the rules and let T3 accompany her inside. She didn't dare offer him any words of comfort. She couldn't do anything that might draw attention to herself. So she simply had to let the young man suffer, silently hoping his mental anguish would quickly pass once she went inside.
Please follow me,
he stammered. Still trembling, he had led her to a table in the back where a Sith in expensive courtier's clothes was already seated. She could tell by his appearance, and even by the way he sat, that he was more diplomat than warrior. There was something soft and supple about his appearance. His muscles were not well defined, and he didn't seem to possess the physical self-awareness common among those who relied on their martial skills to survive. He was clearly part of the aristocracy. Mitra made a mental note not to underestimate him. What he lacked in physical prowess, he probably more than made up for with intellect and cunning. Setchel dismissed the young slave with a disparaging flick of his wrist, then motioned for her to sit down at the table in the chair across from him. As she did, he flashed a well-practiced smile, and she noticed something odd about his face. In addition to their red skin, the Sith were marked by fleshy tendrils that dangled from cheeks and chin. On Setchel, two of the tendrils were disfigured stumps. It appeared as if they might have been cut off. She pulled her focus away from his cheeks and up to his eyes, lest he catch her staring at his deformity.
"Larvet tells me you are looking for someone,"
Setchel said, jumping right to the matter at hand.
"He said you could help me find him,"
Mitra replied.
"For the right price, I can find almost anyone,"
Setchel assured her.
And I happen to know you have more than ample funds to cover my costs.
I see Larvik does not believe in discretion when it comes to discussing business matters,
Mitra grumbled.
If you didn't want him to discuss the terms of your deal, you should have negotiated that into the price,
Setchel replied.
Shall I assume you want our discussions to remain private?
Mitra nodded, wondering how much of a premium that would be.
Tell me about the person you are looking for.
I'm looking for a Sith.
Mitra wasn't foolish enough to admit she was looking for Revan. Without knowing who had taken him or why, even bringing him up would be too great a risk. Thanks to T3's holorecording, however, she knew what the Sith who had captured him looked like. Hopefully, if she could find his abductor, he might lead her to Revan.
Does this Sith have a name?
He probably does, but I don't know what it is.
Ah, progress,
Setchel said, clapping his hands together and rubbing them in anticipation.
Now we know he is male. Can you provide me a description?
I can do better than that,
she answered, pulling a personal holo projector from one of her pockets. She flicked a switch, and it displayed a still image she had copied from T3's holo recording. The image was carefully cropped to remove all traces of Revan or the Ebon Hawk, leaving only a close-up of the Sith who had taken him. Setchel's reaction to the image was so subtle that Mitra almost didn't notice it. His eyes widened slightly in recognition, an instinctive, unconscious reaction. It lasted only a fraction of a second, and Mitra was impressed with how well he was able to hide his surprise.
Interesting,
the Sith said, pretending to study the picture.
He appears to be a Sith Lord. That means I will have to charge extra.
There was no doubt in Mitra's mind that Setchel knew exactly who the Sith Lord was, but she thought there was more benefit to playing along than calling him on his lie.
I need to speak with him on an urgent matter.
Perhaps if you tell me the nature of your business, it will help me track him down. Is he a friend? An enemy?
Not a friend, exactly,
Mitra said evasively.
But certainly not an enemy. He has information about a private matter that I wish to discuss.
Keeping information from me will make my job more difficult,
Setchel warned her.
It will drive up the price substantially.
You already know I can pay,
she reminded him.
My business will remain private.
If I do locate this being, what should I tell him?
Mitra hesitated. She didn't know the exact nature of the relationship between Setchel and the mysterious Sith. If they were friends, he wouldn't simply tell her where to find him, not without warning him first.
I would like you to set up a meeting between us,
she said finally, hoping her answer was vague enough that Setchel might still suspect she didn't mean the other Sith any harm.
A private meeting, yes?
He asked with a smile. Mitra nodded.
Very well,
he said.
I will try to locate him and offer to set up a meeting. Of course, I can make no promise that he'll agree to see you.
It's in his best interest,
Mitra said.
I'm sure you can be very convincing.
Certainly, but that also costs extra.
Mitra sighed wearily.
How much?
5,000 credits.
Setchel proved to be a much shrewder negotiator than Larvit. He knew he had all the leverage. In the end, they settled on 4,000 credits, much closer to his opening offer than Mitra had originally intended. She rose to leave the table, then was hit by a sudden inspiration.
How much to purchase the slave at the door?
She asked. If she could buy the young man, she could give him his freedom.
If you are interested in purchasing slaves, you'll find a much better selection in the city's central market,
he assured her.
I'm interested in him specifically,
she said,
Why?
There was no mistaking the sudden suspicion in Setchel's voice, and Mitra knew she had misplayed her hand.
I like his look,
she said with a coy smile.
You can hire his services by speaking with the concierge of the club,
he said.
That's something I'll have to look into,
she said, her heart sinking as she realized she could do nothing for the young man now. Setchel wouldn't just forget about her unusual interest in an otherwise anonymous slave. If she did anything to help him win his freedom, it would certainly get back to Setchel, and she couldn't risk blowing her cover.
Would you like me to have him escort you out?
Setchel offered.
Thank you,
she said, grinning lasciviously. The young man was summoned to the table, and she could feel his fear at being singled out by the woman he thought he had offended earlier. He didn't speak as he led her to the door, where T3 was waiting for them.
It was our pleasure to serve you, mistress,
he said, his voice cracking.
Everything was satisfactory,
she said, her voice dripping with disdain and contempt. The slave bowed and backed away, obviously relieved at what he perceived to be a more normal reaction from a patron of the club. Once he vanished back inside, Mitra spun on her heel and walked away quickly, anxious to put the club behind her. T3 scurried to keep up, beeping out a question.
We're getting closer,
she promised him. Then she added,
the sooner we're off this accursed world, the better.
Chapter 21
You will understand in time.
Back in his private quarters, Scourge tried to push the last words of his most recent conversation with Revan from his mind, but they kept returning. It had been almost a week since he'd walked out on Revan, abandoning him to suffer the torments of his solitary confinement. They had been talking about visions, how the Force could speak to you if you listened, how it could show you visions of your possible future. The Jedi had implied that he had witnessed something to do with his eventual release from Nyriss's prison, but Scourge knew better than to take anything the captive said at face value. Revan was smart. Even as Scourge used him to learn about the Force, the Jedi was trying to manipulate Scourge into helping him escape. It was possible everything he'd said had been nothing but lies. It was also possible he had been telling the truth. Maybe he really had seen something that gave him hope of escape. Scourge knew he should tell Nyriss about this latest development, but so far he had kept silent on the matter. If she knew, there was a strong chance she would simply decide to execute Revan, rather than allow him any opportunity to escape. And that was the real problem. If Revan died, did any real chance of stopping the Emperor die with him? When the Jedi said Nyriss would never step forward to lead the others against the Emperor, the words rang true. Revan, on the other hand, had already proved he was both eager and willing to stop the Sith from invading the Republic. He had hinted at an alliance between them, and as ridiculous as it might have seemed at first, Scourge couldn't help but see some merit in the idea. They shared a strong commitment to a common goal. Alliances had been forged on far less. But agreeing to work with the Jedi wouldn't just mean freeing him from his cell. It would mean a betrayal of Nyriss. And Scourge wasn't ready to take on both her and the Emperor quite yet. Especially when all of this was predicated on an alleged Force vision of Revan's that might not actually have existed. The sharp knock on his door came as a relief. His mind was running in circles. It would be good to have something to distract him. When he opened the door, he was surprised to see Setchel standing on the other side. For the most part, the sycophantic Sith had avoided him for the last 3 years, partly out of fear, and partly because Nyriss had forbidden him from seeking vengeance for the brutal interrogation that had left him scarred for life. There had been occasions where they had been forced to work together on some task or mission for Nyriss, but the innate mistrust all Sith had of one another had escalated between them to the point that it actually impacted their ability to work effectively together. It hadn't taken long for Nyriss to realize their talents were put to better use independently.
"Why are you here?"
Scourge asked.
"I have news you will be interested in,"
Setra replied, smiling in a way that made Scourge want to strangle him.
"Did Nyriss send you?"
"I am here of my own volition."
"What is this about?"
Scourge demanded.
"Aren't you going to invite me in?"
"No."
Setchel shrugged.
"I was only trying to show some discretion, for your sake."
"Get to the point,"
Scourge said through gritted teeth.
"A woman came to me today. Human. She's looking for you."
"A human? Why?"
"She didn't say. She didn't offer her name, and given her reluctance to discuss the matter, I didn't ask."
"If she found you, then she already knows where to find me,"
Scourge said. Setchel shook his head.
"We crossed paths quite by accident. She has no idea you and I know each other at all. She simply hired me to find you."
"Maybe you'd better come in and tell me the whole story,"
Scourge said, relenting and stepping aside.
"On second thought, I think I'll stay out here,"
the other Sith replied.
"I get the feeling you don't like the answers I'm giving you."
"Do you think I need to get you alone to inflict pain?"
Scourge asked, casually reaching out with the Force to give Setchel's windpipe a quick squeeze. Setchel gasped and threw his hands up to his throat, his eyes wide with fear.
"Nyriss will have your head if you harm me again,"
he blustered.
"That won't bring you back if you're dead,"
Scourge pointed out.
"Now stop playing games and tell me exactly what happened."
"This woman was referred to me by a business associate,"
Setchel explained.
"She offered me a substantial sum to track down the man in her hollow image."
"A hollow image?"
"Apparently she doesn't even know your name, but she has an excellent image of your face, and she's willing to pay a substantial sum to meet with you."
"And you have no idea why?"
"I can speculate."
"Please do,"
Scourge said grimly.
"Think of how many lives you have ended, how many assassinations you've performed. Isn't it possible that on one of these missions, your face was captured by a security cam?"
Scourge was always careful on his missions, but nobody was perfect.
"It's possible,"
he admitted grudgingly.
"Now imagine someone who knew the victim finds the footage. Maybe a wife or a daughter. Driven by her lust for revenge, she could search the whole empire for the one who wronged her."
"You think she wants to kill me?"
"Probably. Most people do. But she insisted on meeting you in person."
"Why are you telling me this?"
Scourge asked abruptly.
"I have a reputation to protect. She paid me to do a job. I don't want rumors to spread that I cheated a client. It's bad for business."
"Does Nyriss know about your so-called business?"
"She allows me to freelance as long as it doesn't interfere with my work on her behalf. And in this case, it may actually benefit her and you," he added. "If this woman intends you harm, she must be dealt with appropriately. That is why I think you should meet with her."
"And there's always a chance she might actually succeed, isn't there?"
"Doubtful,"
Setchel said.
"Just to be on the safe side, though, I wouldn't suggest you go to meet her alone."
"You want to come with me?"
"Not in the least," Setchel assured him. "This seems more like a job for Murtaugh and his crew."
Scourge didn't speak right away. He ran over everything Setchel had told him, trying to determine if he was being set up. The mere fact that Setchell hadn't simply turned the woman away was enough to make Scourge wary of the meeting. If someone really was looking to do him harm, it was doubtful that Setchell would warn him simply because they both served Nyriss. But if he suspected the woman was